I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. He's joined in conversation by journalist Janine Zakaria. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Ehud Barak and Janine Zakaria.
Israelis are no strangers to short stretches packed with historic and turbulent events, but the highs and lows of this week have felt unprecedented. Arguably, no one understands the enormous challenges that Israel faces today better than our guest this evening, Ehud Barak. As one of its preeminent military and political leaders, his life has been entwined from the very beginning with his country's. From 1999 to 2001, Mr. Barak served as Israel's prime minister. He was the leader of the Labor Party from 2007 until 2011, and minister of defense, first in Ehud Olmert's government and then in Bibi Netanyahu's government from 2007 to 2013. Before entering politics, he was the chief of staff for the IDF. Mr. Barak holds a bachelor's of science in physics and math from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and a master's of science degree from our local Stanford University in engineering and economic systems. His new book, My Country, My Life, is a powerful and frank account of both Israel's history and Mr. Barak's own. Appearing in conversation with him this evening is Janine Zakaria. Janine reported on Israel, the Middle East, and U.S. foreign policy for close to two decades, including stints as Jerusalem bureau chief for the Washington Post, State Department correspondent for Bloomberg News, Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post, and Jerusalem correspondent for Reuters. She is currently the Carlos Kelly McClatchy Lecturer in the Department of Communications at Stanford University. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Ehud Barak and Janine Zakaria.
Good evening, everyone. It's a great honor for me to have been asked to interview Prime Minister Barak on the occasion of his new memoir. And what I'd like to do is just briefly try and frame our discussion and try and relate some of the themes from the book to the events that we are witnessing now. Now, for those in this audience who know you, they probably know you as Israel's most decorated soldier or as Israeli prime minister who tried to secure a peace deal with Yasser Arafat in 2000. I myself covered you when you were Ramatkal, chief of staff, your election in 99, chased you around in 2000 at the Camp David and Shepherdstown peace summits, and first interviewed you in 2010 when you were defense minister in Prime Minister Netanyahu's government. So I knew a lot about you, but boy, I did not realize until I read this book just how much of a direct role you had in practically every major episode in Israel's history. It's a book not only about your life, the major episodes, but also about giant historical figures with whom you cooperated and clashed over the years. Three who are gone, Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, and Ariel Sharon, and one who is still very much here with us, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who you commanded as a soldier and served as defense minister in his government. And it's truly an honest memoir where I felt you taking stock of where you were right most of the time and where you may have erred. But there was one point on which you were quite sure, and you opened the book with this practically, so it's why I wanted to start here with you about this point tonight. It's on what you perceive as the greatest threat you see to Israel today. And given the events of the past 2 weeks, President Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear accord, Israeli strikes on Iranian military bases in Syria, the Palestinian protests in Gaza on Monday, in which the IDF killed 60 people, Hamas fighters and civilians, in a reminder of how volatile the conflict remains with the Palestinians, this audience may be surprised to hear what you write is the greatest threat to the country. It isn't a nuclear Iran or Hezbollah or Molotov cocktails attached to kites from the Gaza Strip. You say the main threat, it comes from the inside, quote, from the most right-wing, deliberately divisive, narrow-minded, and messianic government we have seen in our seven-decade history. So I thought you could talk about this, about how you see Israel right now and why you identified this internal threat as the most consequential.
So Israel is basically the most successful national project of the 20th century. Within 70 years, we started practically from nothing. We ended up, after 70 years, the strongest country, 1,000 miles around Jerusalem, not just militarily, but also strategically, technologically, economically. We are not the largest economy, but by far the most vibrant one. And basically out of this position of strength and self-confidence, we could decide our future. And we have been through seven wars and two intifadas and infinite number of operations in between. But when we come to the question, where are we heading? For a long time, I saw that our government doesn't know where they want to reach or where they want to end the whole journey. The old Greek used to say that if you do not know which port you want to reach, no wind will take you there. But in the last 3 years, having a purely right-wing government, I found it embarrassing to see that there is a purpose and a very worrying one, namely to block the door on any option of future disengagement or divorce, as I call it, from the Palestinians in order to create a two-state solution, which is the only viable and sustainable one. To those of you who probably do not fully understand why it's so important, the problem is both painful and simple. Between River Jordan and Mediterranean, there live 13 million people, half of them Jews, half of them Arabs. If there is only one entity, political entity, named Israel, reigning over this whole area, it will become inevitably, and that's the key word, inevitably, either non-Jewish or non-democratic, because if this block of millions of Palestinians, these clear and apparent national aspirations, will be able to vote to the Knesset, that's bi-national state overnight, and within a few years, bi-national state with Muslim majority and permanent civil war. If they cannot vote, that's not a democracy. I don't want to quote the name of the example in the neighboring continent in the previous century. That's not democracy for sure. Neither is the Zionist dream. And when you talk to right-wingers, people, intelligent people, knowledgeable, educated, and ask them, how can you avoid this dead end, tragic dead end of the Zionist project? When all the arguments are exhausted, they look to heaven. They basically wait to some divine intervention. Now, I found it quite embarrassing that when you talk to some ideologue of the Hamas in a European university, and you ask him, how come you dare to think of destroying Israel? Israel is the most powerful player, allegedly a nuclear power. What exactly Hamas can do to destroy it? He looks to heaven. Whoever knows the history of Islam, how it gets out of Judaism, basically, understand that if there is anyone there, he's the same one. So at least one of the two sides is wrong, and probably it is us, not them. So it's a bizarre situation where intelligent people with a wide background and record, and I criticize, I'm probably the harshest critique of our government, but it is a freely elected government and a legitimate one, but it goes in the wrong direction. So we have a compelling imperative to block this slippery or drift on the slippery slope towards one-state solution, not because of the Palestinians. I can care about them as a human being, but I don't care about them as Israeli. I care about our security, our future, and our identity. And out of those very elements, we have to insist that by no way, no trick, and no brainwashing or under no disguise, this effort will continue to drive us beyond certain kind of abstract point of no return into the abyss of one state.
Prime Minister Barak, when I interviewed you 2 years ago at Texas A&M, we were on stage with Hanan Ashrawi, a longtime PLO negotiator. And at the time, I felt that you were reluctant to say the kind of things that you just said about a right-wing government headed by Prime Minister Netanyahu. And in the book, you praise him for his intellect and his abilities as a soldier, but you blast him for embracing a kind of victimhood mentality that deliberately ignores the Israeli strength you just outlined. And you say, quote, "My concern is the vision he is peddling at home and abroad about Israel, the notion that we are too weak to confront whatever dangers might threaten us. Why do you think he does this, and what is the consequence of that?"
First of all, I should tell you, I never complain about our government. When on the other side of the table, there sits a Palestinian. Lady Ashrawi would immediately use it prove that me and her think the same way, which is not not reality. to come to the point you raise, it's I know Bibi from the time he was 20 years old, young officer under my command. He was a good officer, an operational good officer, practical and ambitious. And even now, as you mentioned, he's a knowledgeable, it's not a lightweight, he understands history. But he drifted into a mindset which is extremely pessimist, passive, anxious, and self-victimizing. And that's, to make sure, is quite a good recipe for politics, because you don't initiate anything, so you can never be blamed for anything. And if something happens, you always can complain about the circumstances, the heaven, or whatever. Say you are not demigod. But it's a very poor recipe for statesmanship. And it's, in a way, I call it the real post-Zionism. Zionism has been based from day one on the idea that we are going to take our fate in our hands and proactively act in order to... You know, the young lady who shouted just from this side, she mentioned 2011. I don't exactly got what she meant, but 11 years earlier, in 2000, I sat down with the Palestinian leader at the time, Arafat, together with President Clinton. And we put on the table a far-reaching offer that might make the Free Palestine, celebrating its 10th anniversary already, or probably 15th anniversary already. So when we put it, unlike the urban legends that were spread around the world, that we tried to dictate it to Arafat or to basically tell him, take it or leave it, it never happened. It was a far-reaching offer where we told him, you should not accept any single paragraph, or probably all of them. You might have your reservation for every paragraph, but we just ask you to take it as a basis for negotiation. And the offer basically answered metaphorically 90%+ of anything he could think of. And he deliberately rejected it and turned to terror. So in a way, it was another proof of the old saying that our legendary foreign minister Abba Ibn used to say, that the Palestinians never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. In a way, the responsibility for not having a Palestinian state is for 70 years on their shoulders. I was 6 years old, but fully aware that something extremely dramatic happening in front of our eyes that had no precedent since the biblical times, when the General Assembly decided about the establishment of two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state. Ben-Gurion, on behalf of the Zionist movement, accepted it, in spite of the fact that the Jewish state was almost unsustainable. Three cantons, hardly connected, without Jerusalem, without even a corridor to Jerusalem. And Ben-Gurion accepted it. But the Palestinian movement not just rejected it and opened war the next morning, but the day, 15th of May, where when Israel was established, invited the neighboring armies to come. We survived. But that was the reason why I said in at Camp David, I told Clinton in front and Arafat, or Clinton in front of Arafat, I told him, you know, Mr. President, you had not yet been born, but Arafat was already a teenager and I was a young boy. And I can tell you, we will never, ever be apologetic about surviving this attempt on our life. And even the refugee story, it's true. Near my kibbutz, there was an Arab village, Wadi Khawaret, and they disappeared. They went out to the West Bank on April 48. And 650,000 Palestinians left what became Israel. But within the same 2 years and the 2 years afterwards, the Israeli population, which was also 650,000, absorbed 650,000 Jews coming from the whole Arab world. And we never called them refugees. We called them brothers, and they and their offspring are now majority of the population of Israel. So that's here the difference. That's why I told Clinton at the same gathering and Arafat in front of his face, we fully understand the problems that refugees have, but we will never accept moral responsibility for this. It is totally asymmetric story.
Prime Minister Barak, Yasser Arafat indeed proved not to be a willing partner for peace, as you outline in great detail. But he's been dead since 2004. And here we are, just few months shy of the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Peace Accords, and we're nowhere near the peace deal that you say obviously is in Israel's interest. This idea that this critical thing that you just said, that you offered the most generous offer and Arafat didn't even respond, has led to this narrative of Ein Lanu Partner, there is no partner for Israel, that has persisted for the past 18 years. So can you talk a little bit about how we get past this and maybe a new formula or some kind?
You know, I'm the one who is blamed for coining this term, there is no partner. But in reality, what I've said is something different. I said there is no partner in Arafat at the present time, which was just an objective description of the situation. I tried to convince my own camp, the left, center-left camp in Israel, that no answer from the other side should paralyze us from moving ahead with the objectives of Zionism. We tried our best. Responsibility for rejecting it is on the other side's shoulder, but it shouldn't paralyze it. It's a well-known truth that for a war, one side suffices. Peace is like tango. It takes two. So if the other side doesn't want it, we should ask ourselves what to do. And it was clear to me the next step should be to delineate a line within the holy promised land, a line within which we'll have all our security needs, some 80% of the settlers in what is called the settlement blocks, and within which we'll have a solid Jewish majority for generations to come, and beyond which we'll still keep our overall security control, because security is ahead and above any other consideration, but the place will be there for a Palestinian demilitarized, viable state. At the moment, they will be wiped for it. And in fact, 90% of security people in Israel now organize in a body called the Commanders for the Security of Israel, whoever wants to have a look into what should be done on the ground concretely right now, can go to the site and find what the leaders of the IDF, leaders of Secret Service, leaders of Mossad, leaders of police, what they think about how to make sure our security maximized. But what is common to 90% of them, they argue that Israel will be better protected and better, more secure and more effective in struggling against terror if we will have a line that probably takes 6 or 8 or 10% of the West Bank, compensated by certain land swaps, but having a Palestinian responsibility behind it. As the poet, the American poet Robert Frost once put it, good fences make good neighbors.
You're listening to former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, whose new memoir is My Country, My Life. He's joined in conversation by journalist Janine Zakaria on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So the issue on which Camp David really struggled the most was Jerusalem. And you described the different formulas that President Clinton had wanted to present and the pressure you were on back home when it leaked that there may be some discussion of division of the city. And amid those leaks, you said, you wrote, for the first time, all Israelis recognized what their political leaders, both Labor and Likud, had long known, if not publicly acknowledged. A formal final peace with the Palestinians would require us not just to withdraw from the great majority of the West Bank, which you just detailed, but to find a formula for sharing power in Jerusalem. So in light of this, can you talk about President Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem before there's any peace deal?
I think that it's a good decision. We welcome it. I think it should have been taken 70 years ago, but for sure 25 years ago when the Congress, in a bipartisan resolution, passed it as a demand to the president. I don't agree that justified the great alienation it raised in Palestinian minds and Arabs. In fact, it does not exclude the possibility, or I would say the certainty, that if at the right time the Palestinians will be ready to strike a deal and the Palestinian state will be established.
There was a lot of religion in the ceremony. And but there weren't
too much, not necessarily Jewish religion.
No, not necessarily Jewish religion. A lot of evangelical Christian religion, too. And but there weren't a lot of Democrats. In fact, there were no Democrats at the ceremony. Are you concerned that Israel, and maybe in light of what we've just been experiencing here, is no longer, there's no longer a bipartisan consensus in the U.S. about Israel?
Yeah, I'm extremely worried about it. It started not just with these events, it started long ago. Probably the first clear chasm was created around the Iranian deal when it was signed. The morning after the signing event in Vienna, Bibi called me, asked to talk, to discuss what should be done. I told him, look, we all think this is a bad deal. I once said that when I first heard about it, I was asked how I feel about the deal. I answered, mixed feelings. You know what is mixed feelings? It's when your mother-in-law drives your new BMW over the cliff.
This joke I understand.
So I told Bibi that something from everyone's experience, so you understand. So I told Bibi, no, we should make no secret our feelings about what's bad in this deal. And we can talk as human beings, even politicians who know many Americans, go from one senator to the other, from one congressman to another, and tell them why it is bad. But we cannot cross a thin line when we are doing it as the state of Israel. We expect the Americans to respect our own sovereignty. It came to quiet, uneasy meetings that I described in a book that I had with President Bush Jr. and then with Obama, where I told them when it comes to issues which has to do with our very security and the future of Israel and, in a way, the Jewish people. We cannot afford delegating the authority for making decisions to anyone, including our best friends, which happen to be you. We will take our decisions as a sovereign and will act upon them. And they didn't like this answer, but they always respected it. And I used to tell Bibi and others in the cabinet, the same way that we expect the Americans to respect our sovereignty, we have to respect their sovereignty. And so we cannot dictate to them. We cannot enter behind the lines into the Congress and fight against the president, in a freely elected president within the body politics and political process of America. So I felt even then that we are creating a gap. And in a way, you could see it here.
You talked about Iran, and you talk in the book about tense conversations you had with President Obama about a possible Israeli military strike. And your concern about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, I think, is the same as Bibi's. But where you differ is when he invokes the Holocaust, for example, to talk about this threat. And you quite profoundly describe a conversation you had with him when you were defense minister. You said, "You're prime minister of the state of Israel, not a rabbi in a shtetl or a speaker trying to raise funds for Israel abroad. If Iran gets a bomb, it'll be bad, very bad, but we'll still be here, and we will find a way for dealing with the new reality." Can you talk about how worried you are about that possibility, and also President Trump's decision to leave the Iran agreement that you originally disagreed with, but his decision to leave it?
I'm deeply worried, and during those years I was more hawkish than Bibi about the need to make sure that we are prepared, both operationally and in terms of international legitimacy, to the extent we can control it, and ready to act if it will become clear that not acting means that we won't be able to act. For different reasons that are detailed in the book, it didn't happen. But once again, all along these discussions, I never could understand this rhetoric of Europe in 1938 and the risk of destruction of Israel. We have to do whatever it takes to make sure that they won't get nuclear weapons. And we, even now, after Trump pulled out from the agreement, the best thing to do is to meet behind closed doors and discuss how to make sure that enough intelligence resources are investing in knowing what they are doing, how we define a breakout, namely the Iranian attempt to go into nuclear weapon, and at what stage surgical military operations should be brought to the table, American or Israeli. These all should be agreed behind a closed door. But the discussion or descriptions of apocalyptic scenarios, both in cabinet and sometimes public, I didn't like. I used to tell them, look, what do you think a sober and open, kind of far-sighted Jew in Europe in 1938 should have been doing? He should flee out of Europe. So what exactly you compare here? What's the comparison? Assume that for some reasons that are beyond our control, even if they agree and comply totally with a much tighter deal, assume that a political meltdown in Pakistan end up that when the dust settled 2 weeks after Pakistan collapsed, you will find half a dozen of nuclear weapons in Saudi Arabia and half a dozen in Iran. Are we going to close the Zionist project? Are we going to pack our properties and go back to North Africa or Eastern Europe? No, we are here. We are still the strongest power around. It won't come without certain assessment of the new situation, certain steps, some of the steps we are taking for more than 20 years now, just to face the prospect that at a certain point, some neighbor, probably in the outer circle, will turn nuclear. We are doing a lot about investing huge resources. So basically, I don't like apocalyptic thinking. It doesn't help to balance the judgment of those who have to take decisions. and it usually confuses the public and sows anxiety in their minds. And in a way, leave this aside, I open a bracket, it's not the only reflection of this attitude. In a way, our government is interested in having the public being always anxious and worried of kind of a immediate existential threat, however imagined. And they need it, because the only way to convince our public to take the steps which are needed, the practices, the legislation, whatever is waiting us down the stream toward this situation where you control permanently over millions of people against their will. And we have seen it in other places. Practices, legislations, orders to the Secret Service and the Army might be quite tough, and a strong, healthy democracy would not tend to accept them. So you have, in order to prepare the public for this situation, you have to unite them around two themes: existential threat from without and traitors from within. It's typical for all authoritarian regimes all along the last 200 years. It always repeats itself. In order to take a public and make it coherent about these ultra-nationalist themes, you have to invent these demons from without and traitors from within. And that's exactly what's happening now. It's no secret. The very institutions of democracy are now under straight attack by our own freely elected government. It reminds me of autoimmune diseases. The attack on the Supreme Court and its authority comes from within the government. The attack on the NGOs and the human rights NGOs and whatever on civil society comes from within the government. The attacks on the free press and the attempt to buy, to control them through ownership, as many as possible out of them, comes from within the government, at the top of the government. And even the attack in the last 2 years on the very basic values of the IDF and its commander's echelon is coming from the government. And that, these are all elements of what I described as this drift on the slippery slope toward a one-state solution that inevitably brings with it the expectation to be able to violate the international law or to violate any norms of advanced democracy.
So I really want to get to Gaza, and there's going to be a lot of questions in here about this, but I want to pick up on this point that you just made, because one of the organizations that's been demonized by the Israeli government is the New Israel Fund, which is right here, based in San Francisco. And so imagine that you have people in the audience here who love Israel, okay, and maybe spend some time there, speak Hebrew, but they're concerned and they're worried about what they saw as Palestinians being killed, the occupation. They want to speak out about it. So do they have a place in Israel in 2018? What role can we have out here?
I think, first of all, raise your voice. Don't accept this norm that Jews in the diaspora have to repeat, like a looper, the voices coming from our government. Israeli government aspire to be the government of all Jews, so all Jews have a voice. It has to do with our policies. It has to do with the question to what extent Israel still are capable of holding the moral high ground vis-a-vis the neighbors, and it even relates to what happens along the Kotel with the
Western Wall.
Reform and conservative. These are all developments that should not have happened, and they are happening because the government feels that there is no enough resistance. And in a way, Netanyahu himself lost control of the direction he's led and pushed by the extreme right, by a small party called Jewish Home or whatever. And these are very dangerous directions for the unity of our people and for the fate of Israel. So the only answer is to fight. We have nothing to fear except beyond fear itself, as the FDR once said on other subjects. So we have to raise. You have to raise your voice. I told the leaders of the Reform community that whenever I come and spend a Friday evening in a Reform family, I tell my wife they are more Jewish than I am. They know the text. They know what's Abdallah, what's Ezeh, what's the Moitzi, to throw the pieces of challah. I never went to synagogue. I didn't have even a normal bar mitzvah. And I don't feel less Jewish than anyone at the chief rabbinate. I don't accept the authority of anyone to tell me how to be a Jew, how to express my Jewishness, obviously. So I think that that's first. Second, support those who are fighting in Israel. They fight themselves, sometimes very good people, sometimes fighters who fought and risked their life for the country, attacked as if they are really, in a way, traitors. There is a very kind of easy by which they trying to connect them to whoever of our enemies. And I think that we have to wake up. That's what I'm doing right now, beyond my kind of roles and also of the one and only book that I probably will write. I fly a lot, so I have a jet lag, so I wake up at 2 o'clock a.m., I don't know what to do, so I think of President Trump and I start to tweet. And I noticed that it can penetrate only if it's very blunt. So to tell you the truth, personally, I have certain sympathy for Bibi. I wish, you mentioned the investigation, I wish that it will end up with nothing about him. And I don't think that he has a criminal mind. But he is for so long in power, so somehow the boundaries of what is done, what isn't done, get somehow blurred, at least to the whole inner circle around him, hopefully not for himself. But however I sympathize with him as a human being, I find no way, but in order to wake up and put a light on the real important issues at our door, I write a quiet kind of brutal tweets and send them. And I think that everyone from his place has to take a position and not hiding it. We have really nothing to be afraid of.
So they brought me the questions here, and we can now maybe talk a little bit about Gaza, which very often in these kinds of discussions gets overlooked, and from the events of recent days cannot be. And so the first question is whether you believe there's a viable alternative to dealing with the Gaza protests to using live ammunition.
Technically, from today to next day, there is very little that could be changed. When you look at the deeper future or a little bit into the past, a lot could have been done differently. In fact, both the IDF, the Secret Service, the Shabak, and the coordinator of government activities in the territories, which is an office headed by a general, they all put forward many ideas what could be done in order to reduce the tension with the Gazans. The issue is that we do not have any struggle, any conflict with the Gazans, with the 2 million people. We have an issue only with the Hamas leadership who controls them. Now, when it comes to the actual events, we have very sophisticated means to block a demonstration of the kind of a group of this size, several hundreds from a distance of 20 or 30 yards. we do not have effective means to suppress a riot or demonstration with many thousands of people from a distance of 500 or 300 yards. And that's a different technical operation.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, whose new memoir is My Country, My Life. He's joined in conversation by journalist Janine Zakaria. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Now, we have to block them that far because the fence itself is very, very fragile, and we cannot, Israel cannot afford the waves of Palestinians incited by Hamas and organized by Hamas coming on mass into Israel. Not just because of the symbolic importance of a border, and there is a symbolic importance, especially for us, for those of us who believe that the solution is two states, that disengagement from the Palestinians, and long before having a peace agreement, we should have a border, first of all. We have to respect borders, but it is for practical reasons as well. Sometimes 100 yards from the fence, there is the first homes of certain moshav, or several hundred yards, the infrastructure of a kibbutz. So we just cannot technically afford it happening.
Just to be clear, you're saying that Israel had no choice but to use live ammunition in this scenario, the way it got?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. No one is happy to see 50,000 people dead, and even two deaths is too much. We are not happy for it, and Israeli commanders, soldiers are now making a lot of effort, unfortunately not fully successful, to reduce the number of fatalities. But the events 2 days ago cannot be summoned as an achievement in this regard. But I can hardly see a different option. And it's painful, but that's the reality. I'm sure that there is a lot of work being done now, how to control, if it happens once again, several months from now, what ways might be found to suppress a coming riot when it is still 300 yards from you. I hope these efforts will be successful.
There's like 6 questions here about the settlements.
Two and a half minutes each.
Talk about the settlements. Can we ever see a change in settlement policy? How can we get a deal without some change to the settlements?
I made my position very clear. The main enemy of 80% of the settlers who are living in the settlement blocks and in 12 Jewish neighborhoods in Jerusalem is their own government, who deliberately erased the difference between those 80% of the settlers inside the settlement blocks, where all Israelis, left and right, except for the margins on the left, all agree that these settlement blocks should remain part of Israel. Many of you know them. It's Gush Etzion, Male Edomim, Givat Ze'ev, Ariel Kedumim, a few religious cities along the border. So together with the 220,000 Israelis living in Jewish suburbs beyond the old Green Line in Jerusalem, these are the 80%. The government insists on keep being active in about 100 settlements with about 100,000 people, which we call the isolated settlements. They are stuck or spread all over the Judea and Samaria in between any two significant villages or towns. And the only logic behind them is that by their very presence, they might eliminate any possibility of future agreement. So the white policy will be to stick to those 80% within the 5 or 6% of the West Bank area, and together with the neighbors in Jerusalem to create the line, which is basically now a wall and a fence over most of the area, which will separate the solid Jewish majority from the heavily populated Palestinian area. And the argument which is sold to the general public in Israel is that those isolated settlements have a critical role in our security. And I can tell you now professionally, not politically, I spent 35 years in uniform. It's a nonsense. These isolated settlements are a burden over the security in Israel. They need to protect them, to go with them, to make sure to smooth out the friction that is raised by their presence there is a burden on the Israeli security. And it's not just my personal view. If you bring here on one stage, there is enough place here for all former living Ramatkals, chiefs of staff, all living former heads of the Shabak, the Secret Service, all living heads of Mossad, and all living heads of the Central Command, the military command which controls Judea and Samaria. There will be some 30 people on the floor, and 90% from them will tell you Barak is right. These isolated settlements are a burden on the security of Israel rather than an edge. But basically, it's our public is suffering from certain passivity of opposition and highly effective propaganda machine aimed internally into telling the people half-truths or sometimes 1% truths about their real situation.
So there's a few skeptical voices in the audience. One says, how can we be sure a Palestinian state would not ally with Israel's enemies, make an alliance with Israel's enemies? And another question, thank you for your help in trying to secure a peace with these neighbors, but it seems counterintuitive to offer any agreement with those bent on our destruction. Only when Islam has a religious reformation can we consider taking such a risk. Do you want to answer the skeptical voices?
It hits me that following Martin Luther, there were 150 years of religious wars in Europe, then 300 years of national wars in Europe, and only then the European Union had been established. So we have to have a lot of patience for this reform to take. And until then, we have to tackle what we are still having here. Now, the government of Israel trying to tell you, and probably the person who sent this question heard it as well, that as Prime Minister Shamir once put it, "Hayam hu oto hayam ve'aravim otam aravim." The sea is the same sea, the Arabs are the same Arabs, nothing have changed, nothing could change, we have to live on our side forever. That's not true. It's true that the Middle East is a tough neighbor, nothing to compare with the Midwest, and you have to be always alert, always stronger, iron wall, ready to pull the trigger. But to say that nothing is changing is totally untrue. When I was a kid, Israel was established, and I described it. 19 years later, 50 years ago, there was a 6 days war. The Israeli government, immediately after 6 days war, said basically all the territories that we conquered are, except for Jerusalem, is a deposit for peace negotiations. The Arab leadership gathered in Khartoum and announced the three famous no's. No negotiation, no agreement, no recognition. Whatever was taken by force will be brought back by force. So it was true at the time, but it didn't change. We have since then 40 years of peace with Egypt, the most powerful, most important Arab nation. a peace which stood even Israeli tanks rolling into neighboring Arab capital in Beirut. And it didn't collapse. It didn't collapse when Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood took over Egypt. So it's not the same. For 20 plus years, we have a peace with Jordan, and the longest border we have. And not just Rabin and myself, Bibi as well, tried very hard to reach a breakthrough with Assad, the father, not the present one. And Sharon and Begin tried to do the same with Lebanon. So, and now, for 15 years now, the same Arab League, which passed the decision in Khartoum for the three nodes, for 15 years there is on the table the Arab League proposal and the Saudi proposal, which calls for peace, full recognition of Israel, accepting it into the region, based on 67 borders. Of course, we cannot get the 67 borders, and we have a reservation for several other paragraphs in those plans. But to say that nothing has happened from 67 to here with two major pieces, several failed attempts with others, but a clear proposal that I think could be a basis for negotiation if we are serious, that's not the case. And another opportunity on a regional basis, an agreement, which is, once again, it's an opportunity, once in a generation kind of opportunity, to use the common interest that we have with the Sunnite monarchs and leaders, the Gulf State, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, to join hands to struggle against radical Muslim terror, to put at bay or corner the Iranian hegemonic and nuclear intentions, and to join hands in a huge infrastructure project which are needed for the whole region. This is a great opportunity that somehow is missed by us, not just by other powers. It is missed because the precondition for this to fly is to move forward with the Palestinians, not because the Arab leaders have a love affair with them. They do not have, but because their peoples have. And the Arab leaders, be it MBS or Sisi or King Abdullah or MBZ or whoever, they cannot afford, they do not feel safe in their own seats if they engage publicly in Israel and start normalization when the Palestinians are still under our full control in Judea and Samaria and surrounded from all directions in Gaza.
So in other words, being able to do the deal with the Palestinians will open up the prospect of deals with the UAE, with the Saudis, with everybody.
We had to do it for 3 years, and we are not doing it. And that's, once again, part of the strategy of not letting anything happen unless you, first of all, cause the other side to capitulate. That's probably good for some business activities. It doesn't work on the world arena. You will learn it on your own on other subjects.
So we're unfortunately just a few minutes away from the end. And I thought we would just end on this. A lot of people want to know what's going to happen now with the peace process, if anything, given everything you just described, right-wing government, et cetera, Hamas. And I remembered from your book that you said that when you set off for Camp David, which we talked a lot about tonight, that was 52 years after the birth of the state, and you noted that Israel still lacked permanent internationally recognized borders, which you made the case is so important to achieve, and that Israel hadn't achieved the central Zionist aim, which was to be a normal state like all others. Now Israel is 70. How likely is it to be the same as it is now at 75 or 80 or 100?
No, I'm basically optimist. Whenever people tell me, oh, we cannot do anything, that's not true. First of all, you look a wider zoom on history, look at what happened in Northern Ireland. I spent several days in Belfast to see what happened there and how it ultimately was solved after centuries of bleeding into each other hands. Go to former Yugoslavia and you see in Serbia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kosovo, whatever, you could see that even conflict of centuries, once they are solved, you look backward and you cannot understand why the hell we had to wait for so long before coming to our minds and act to solve them. Now, it's not painful solutions. We are not talking about a love affair with the Palestinians. It's more painful divorce. But even painful divorces, California pioneered it, should be accepted when that's the way to continue living normally. And I think that unlike the way that in Europe, immediately post-World War II, within weeks, you could find the Germans were ready and the French were ready to forget everything that happened just a few months ago and start working towards a better future. In the Middle East, conflicts are going, in a way, much deeper. And it will necessarily be, at first, only almost artificial structure, legal structure created by leaderships, probably with international backing, which support a peace. And only then, after the formal contractual structure is there, the generations-long process that goes through education would start toward pacifying the souls and minds of the peoples around. But we should never lose sight of this opportunity and be ready to seize it when it occurs. I'm optimistic because we are strong and we showed in moments of truth a common sense that get over party division and over some kind of euphoric wishful thinking. And I think that when the moment is ripe for it, probably the government had to be replaced, but that's nothing so dramatic in democracy.
Are you going to try and do something about that?
Oh, I hope I won't have to. You can never say never in politics, but bearing in mind what kind of situation should be there, that I feel compelled to jump in spite of all other kind of obstacles, I prefer that it won't happen. But I will remain for sure active in trying to raise the attention of people to what's wrong, what should be done about it, and I'm optimistic that it will happen. In Israel, I'm not worried about our disappearance. The only issue is to make sure that we are putting a wedge on this slippery slope toward one state, and I think that this also should and would happen.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, whose new memoir is My Country, My Life. He was joined in conversation by journalist Janine Zakaria. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.